Welcome to the Pacific Education Pulse podcast, the show that brings you inspiring and cutting-edge information through interviews with movers and shakers who are positively impacting the field of education in Hawaii and beyond. Each episode highlights the work of local and national experts who dedicate their lives to improving teaching and learning so that children and youth reach their full potential. Learn more and subscribe today at pacificeducationpulse.com. Here's your host, Dr. Hugh Dunn.
Aloha, I'm Hugh Dunn, and I'd like to welcome you to the Pacific Education Pulse podcast, the show that keeps your finger on the pulse of education. This program is brought to you by the Pacific Literacy Consortium at plc.crdg.hawaii.edu. Today's guest is Margaret Higa, the Executive Director of the Hawaii Dyslexia Association, where she served in various capacities since 1999. Margaret is a graduate of Sacred Hearts Academy in Honolulu. She received her bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Hawaii at Manoa and a master's degree in counseling psychology from Chaminade University of Honolulu. She's here to share about her work with the Hawaii Dyslexia Association, her journey in this area of service, and resources for teachers and parents who have dyslexic learners. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Hugh. Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, tell us about the International Dyslexia Association and the role of the Hawaii branch.
Okay, so the International Dyslexia Association is one of the oldest learning disabilities associations in the U.S. It's based in Baltimore, Maryland, but as the name suggests, truly has an international approach and focus. The Hawaii branch, is one of 42 U.S.-based branches. There is one branch in Canada. And then there are also, at last count, about 27 global partners. And I must say, the global partners, I mean, they truly are global. I've had the opportunity when attending the International Conference on the Mainland to meet people from dyslexia organizations in Kenya, Japan, the Philippines, Singapore, UK, even the Czech Republic. So truly, truly global. And the International Association was found to kind of honor and continue the work of Samuel Orton, who is really the father of, you may have heard of Orton Gillingham, it's a teaching approach, but also in the work with dyslexia and just really understanding that. So the association was formed for that. And our mission here with the Hawaii branch is really to increase awareness of dyslexia throughout the state, as well as providing support for individuals with dyslexia, their families, teachers who work with them, and also to promote teacher training and inappropriate and effective approaches for working with dyslexic learners and to improve literacy for struggling readers. And again, that's our approach throughout the state, even though we're based in Honolulu.
Wow, that's terrific. That's really far reaching, not only in Hawaii, but across the globe. My understanding is that the International Dyslexia Association and the National Institutes of Health have an official definition of dyslexia. But in a nutshell, what is dyslexia?
Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, dyslexia means difficulty with words. So difficulty, lexia with words. It's a language-based learning disability, and it really describes a cluster of symptoms that results in people having difficulty with specific language skills, particularly reading, but also writing, spelling, and there's other effects that we can maybe talk about later.
And is it the basis of dyslexia? Is it or the origin? Is it environmental, neurological, or genetic, or all of the above?
Right. So the dyslexia is brain-based, so it's neuroanatomical, neurochemical differences in the brain. And I do want to stress, though, that there's nothing wrong with the brain. It's a difference. So in the way that things are processed in the brain of an individual with dyslexia, there's actually been a lot of fMRI studies and other research where they've observed the brain of an individual while reading, and that's how they've come to, you know, their conclusions.
I see.
On the brain basis. Yeah. And then I guess the other piece you asked about is it genetic? And yes, the researchers have found that there is it tends to run in families. So it's pretty unusual in what I've seen if there's only, you know, a single person in a family who has it. So it could be a sibling, you know, parents, grandparents, auntie, uncle, all of the above kind of situation.
Okay. I see. And you mentioned the fMRI, which is functional magnetic resonance imaging.
Right.
It's incredible. I've seen some of those images, and it's really fascinating.
Early in my work with HIDA, I had the opportunity to go to the home office in Baltimore, Maryland. And Guinevere Eden has been one of the, you know, real pioneers in the research. And I'm not sure if she's still there, to be honest, but she was at Georgetown at the time. And we had the opportunity to tour her lab and to actually see the fMRI in, you know, live, just watching what was going on. And I was very new in my position, so a lot of it really was over my head, but very fascinating to see what, you know, what they're doing.
Yes, and I understand that, you know, they say that dyslexia, and you had mentioned it's characteristic of the brain and nervous system, and it's somewhat hardwired into the brain, but does that mean that the wiring cannot be changed?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And that's why early identification and intervention is so important. As, you know, people may know from, you know, we talk about when, you know, your child's an infant, a preschooler, reading to them, being active, and not just for, you know, preparation for school, but just for the development of the child. And so the early identification and intervention, you know, watching the child, knowing the signs, and then being able to provide, you know, appropriate strategies, support, teaching that can help them. The researchers have seen in follow-up fMRIs changes in the way the brain reacts or works while the individual is reading.
Oh, that's amazing. So early identification and intervention is really critical. How many children and adults would you say in Hawaii have dyslexia?
So according to the International Dyslexia Association, they estimate 15 to 20% of the population as a whole have some of the symptoms of dyslexia. So slow, inaccurate reading, poor spelling, poor writing, or even mixing up similar words. So if you kind of do the math with, you know, Hawaii's latest census numbers, that's about 284,000 people in Hawaii alone that, you know, they may not have been identified with dyslexia, but they have some of the symptoms.
Oh, wow. And, you know, these figures might even be underrepresented. The actual situation. Yeah.
Exactly. You know,
I also want to mention that in my current work with the Pacific Literacy Consortium, I serve as the principal investigator for a grant that provides 12 schools with multi-tiered reading supports, including ongoing interim assessments for early identification, and mainly for the purpose of identifying children in need of core, strategic, or intensive reading instruction. So hopefully this helps to minimize the chances of children, some of whom may be dyslexic learners, from falling through the cracks.
Yeah, and when you say early, what grades are you
targeting? We focus on kindergarten to grade 3.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's great.
I often hear, I used to work at, early in my career, I was a public school teacher. I taught at Waianae Elementary School and Kalakaua Middle School. And as a beginning teacher way back then, I recall having some students who seemed to be, you know, pretty gifted, but they demonstrated some phonological deficits that interfered with their learning. And I've heard teachers make comments such as, oh, this child is so bright. If only he would try harder, you know.
Or apply himself.
Right, or apply himself. Yeah. You know, in addition to these phonological deficits, are there other common indicators of dyslexia that a teacher or a parent might observe in a dyslexic learner, whether at home or in the classroom?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I do want to make the point that no two dyslexics are exactly alike. The one thing that does seem to be kind of consistent is the poor spelling. And it's interesting because sometimes when I talk to parents or teachers or even adults who are either self-diagnosing or, you know, just kind of struggling in their work life, they might say, oh, but, you know, I or my child reads really, really well. And I said, how's their spelling? Oh, horrible. Or so that seems to be the one area that it is kind of consistent. But other things that parents or teachers may notice. So let's start with young children. Difficulty with rhyming. So, you know, nursery rhymes, they may not enjoy them. They may not understand them. When you, you know, you say cat, hat, name another worm that rhymes. They might say mittens or something because they're looking at it differently. Well, there's a cat. They have a hat now. Maybe they need mittens. So they're not hearing, you know, those sounds and able to pull them apart. The other thing is the kids may, you know, grow to not like reading, avoid reading, may do things like, oh, you just read it for me. You know, I can read it, but, you know, I'm tired now, or I'm just coming up with different excuses for why, you know, why they can't read. Or they may, other things you may notice is, let's see, the recognizing the words in isolation. So for example, they, you know, they can write out their name, but if you show them their name, you know, somebody else writes it out, shows it to them, they may not recognize it, that's, you know, their own name. Handwriting, you know, difficulty with poor handwriting, either getting the thoughts down on paper or even the mechanics of the writing. So with the writing, which a good example is, you know, say first, second grade, teacher says, oh, we just all came back from, you know, Christmas break, you know, write about what you did, draw a picture, write it, you know, I don't know exact, but write about what you did. And the child who may be struggling might say, we had break, it was fun, I got presents, you know, basically the end. And yet when you talk to the child, you get a lot more rich vocabulary and description of what, you know, they did over their holiday. So that would be something else, yeah, you might see. But, and again, not the other thing I do want to emphasize is that the signs alone don't equal dyslexia. So it could set off a little red flag, if you will, like we need to look more closely at this child and try to see like what's, you know, what's going on, what may, you know, be affecting their ability to do the work. Another thing you may notice actually is the child who acts up, class clown, some behavioral problems, stomach aches, you know, when it's reading time, they suddenly have to go to the bathroom, when it's read aloud time, or, you know, that type of thing, especially in the younger children.
Oh, that's good. That's very good advice. And I like that you said, don't press the panic button.
Well, so, I mean, don't press the panic button, but at the same time, don't wait too long either, because kids can be identified in kindergarten and first grade.
And what about in terms of reading instruction, intervention, what works best for dyslexic learners in terms of how to help them in their reading, in their spelling, mm-hmm. in their language-based difficulties.
Right. So what the research has shown is a type of instruction which is called structured literacy, and it's an umbrella term for teaching that is systematic, that is, it can be multisensory. It teaches the parts of the language. So you mentioned earlier, like phonological awareness, sound symbol mapping, syllables, morphology, or the meaning of the words. Like, what does into mean? What does, you know, in mean or struct mean? And then what does it mean when we put it together with other words? So roots, prefixes, suffixes. It also, it's systematic and cumulative. So you really teach the basics of the language. You don't start with whole words. You start with the simplest unit or sound. So the letters, the phonemes. And it's very explicit. So I mentioned like teaching morphology or the meanings of words. I don't know about you, but every time I watch spelling bees and the kids go, you know, they ask all these questions if they don't know how to spell the word. And then they say word origin. And before I worked for Haida, I used to kind of yell at the TV, like, what does it matter? Just, you know, keep moving on. Stop wasting time. But I've since learned that if you know the word origin, which is what's taught in morphology, then that can help you to know, does the word, for example, end in G-H or is it G-H-T or do you add an E at the end, et cetera. But for dyslexics, it's not intuitive. So you need to teach that. And the other part is it's individualized. So it's seeing what the student needs and kind of ongoing assessment, both informally, so, you know, observing how is the student doing, and then formally with some standard measures. So it's a very, very explicit way. And the good thing is it'll help all children, not just children who struggle. And so that's why our parent organization, IDA, advocates for this type of reading instruction.
Yeah, I was going to say, while you were talking about the systematic, direct, explicit mm-hmm. instructional mm-hmm. method, I was thinking, yeah, this is great for all children, especially right. those without a lot of language experiences early on in their lives.
Right. What you were saying about the project you're working with the K-3, you know, yes. if kids are taught like this from kindergarten, then that, you know, you'll catch those. I mean, some kids are still going to need more intense pull out instruction, right. more individualized, but you should be able to kind of help most students, all different kinds of learners, and those that, you know, maybe are going to take longer, need more intensive help, then that kind of specialized individualized instruction can be provided as well.
Right. And what does the research say, or even from your experience, these children fall through the cracks if they are not mm-hmm. Identified early, and mm-hmm. We don't provide these children with interventions that are designed to help them with their reading and language? What are some of the consequences, not just in the near term, but in long-term consequences?
Right, right. Yeah, unfortunately, there, you know, it's not good. So, you know, one thing is, in the near term, the frustration, stress, anxiety, you know, I gave the example of the kids saying they have to go to the bathroom when they know their turn's going to come up to, you know, in yes. a reading circle or whatever. So you'll see that kind of thing, the, you know, poor self-image, thinking they're stupid, they're dumb. I think you gave the example at the beginning of how, you know, teachers or parents, you know, others will say, well, if you just applied yourself, if you just tried harder. So if a kid keeps hearing that over and over, just thinking like, well, something must be wrong with me because I am trying, you know, I am working hard. And then more long-term consequences, you know, unfortunately, kids with dyslexia and other learning challenges who, you know, don't get the support and kind of intervention necessary, they often drop out of school. They don't go on, you know, to college or work. They may withdraw, attempt suicide, unemployment, and unfortunately, our prisons, you know, are filled with individuals with learning disabilities. And then, you know, for a society as a whole, that leads to, you know, we've lost productive members of society. They, you know, they've lost wages, ability to provide for their families. You know, there's just other societal effects and consequences from that. So it truly is something that, you know, it reading is fundamental. It affects, it is part of our daily lives. You know, everything from talking to friends to, you know, ordering something at the drive-thru, going to the bank. You know, there's so many ways that we use, that we have to read. And if we don't help the kids when they're younger to be successful and to get what they need, then unfortunately, long term, it can just be some really poor outcomes for them and for society as a whole.
That's why I'm glad that the Hawaii Dyslexia Association is getting the word out, and we appreciate the partnership that we have with you. At the beginning of the show, we mentioned some of the indicators of dyslexia. What are some positive traits that are associated mm-hmm. with a dyslexic learner?
Mm-hmm. You know, that is an interesting area right now, because there's kind of, you know, several streams of thought on that. So some people will just say, you know, automatically, well, people with dyslexia are gifted as well. And, you know, they do incredible things in different areas. And then kind of the opposite side of that is, you know, individuals with dyslexia are perhaps no more gifted than the general population. And it might be that because they struggle so much with, you know, reading and some of the more academic tasks, if you will, that they develop or focus on developing other gifts and talents. So there's actually been, you know, an effort. Researchers are looking at it more closely. There's not a definitive answer on that, but what they have kind of agreed upon, or some think, that you may see more out-of-the-box thinking. They have visual spatial talents, kind of the ability to look at something. You know, people who go into, for example, engineering, you know, technical fields, mechanics, some people even say surgeons, were just able to see the patterns, the connections. And in one study that was done in, or published in 2009 out of Cass in the United Kingdom, they found that 35% of US entrepreneurs identified as being dyslexic versus approximately 15% of the general population. So that was a study that's been quoting a lot. And the one thing they noted in the study is that people with dyslexia tend to compensate for things they can't do well by developing excellence in other areas. So, for example, oral communication. They work on that because that becomes a strength for them versus having to read. They delegate. So they may, you know, as entrepreneurs, they run companies, but they have a lot of people around them to do the things that they don't feel that they're good at or that are more difficult for them. Because from early on, they've had to learn to trust other people with tasks they can't do. And then also problem solving and management of people. And wow. Yeah, and I might add perseverance. You know, they've struggled they've had to really kind of, I don't want to say fight, but, you know, just really push to get what they need, maybe fight. And they've had to just work extra hard. You know, when they're in school, they're working, you know, double or more than double the time of their classmates to get the same work done. So that perseverance, that resilience, you know, interestingly, I don't know if you know the show Shark Tank. So several of the sharks are dyslexic.
Is that right?
Yeah. Barbara Corcoran, her for sure. I've read about her. She's actually been at the IDA conference. And
wow.
Yeah. So just kind of amazing.
Wow. That's amazing. I love that show. And you talk about that persistence and the resilience. They definitely have it. Let's say you were talking to a parent who's feeling discouraged, frustrated with herself or himself because he or she's having a difficult time relating to her dyslexic learner. What advice do you have for that parent that can that can help this parent understand and help his or her child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one. And that's, you know, I hear from parents a lot in my work. And there's just kind of a sadness, I think anxiety and fear, because really what they want to know is my child going to be okay? Can they learn? You know, can they be successful? Can they function in life independent of, you know, me, the parent? So one thing that our organization does is, you know, as I mentioned, public awareness of dyslexia is a big part of our mission. And so we at our website have a lot of information there that parents can take a look at, download, print. We have a resource guide about dyslexia, which was just recently updated in 2018. We first published it in 2008, and that's it's been updated, additional information added, and that's 174 pages. So parents can download it as a PDF, or they can get a copy for us, from us. Another thing that I would say that is really impactful and I would highly recommend is a dyslexia simulation workshop. And this actually came out of the Northern California branch of the International Dyslexia Association. And so our branch here in Hawaii, we try to do it at least once a year for the public. And then we also do it, for example, schools may request it for faculty meetings or other groups. So we probably do it 2 to 3 times a year. And what it is, you know, your question was about how can the parents kind of identify or, you know, maybe have a little better understanding of what their kids go through. So in the dyslexia simulations workshop, there's 4 to 6 learning stations, if you will. And those participating, which often are parents, teachers, they rotate through the stations. And in those stations, there's different tasks they need to do. So without giving it all away, generally speaking, they would do reading. There's some writing tasks, some listening tasks. But we, you know, it's a simulation. Nobody can say for sure or really kind of show what it's like to have dyslexia. But, you know, participants leave just profoundly impacted. I mean, we've had, you know, people cry, hug us, you know, say they're going to go home and hug their kids because they've just gone through like a half an hour simulation and their kids are dealing with it 24/7. I mean, it doesn't go away when they leave school. It's 24/7 with them. So that's something I would highly encourage parents to do. There's also other community presentations, publications. We do an annual resource fair. And then, of course, so that's on a local level. And there's also a parent support group that meets in Waikele. And it's for parents of children with attention and learning differences. And they meet monthly. They bring in speakers. Haida has, I've spoken there several times. And so that's a good place just, you know, to be with other parents who are going through the same journey who maybe are further along in the journey and just to get, you know, really, I can't stress it enough, getting information to learn about dyslexia. And then on a national level or through the internet, there's a lot of good resources through our International Dyslexia Association. They have fact sheets, infographics. They have an annual conference, which, by the way, will be in Portland, Oregon this year. So, you know, one of the closest sites for us here in Hawaii. They've added a virtual conference. So if you're unable to go to the mainland, you can sign up to do it virtually from your computer. And they also have a dyslexia handbook, What Every Family Should Know, which just gives you the nuts and bolts of dyslexia and how to help. There are a few other websites that I would highly recommend. One is called understood.org. There's also ldonline.org. And then the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, which Drs. Bennett and Sally Shaywitz, the authors of Overcoming Dyslexia, that's their work. And so those are really great, great online resources as well.
Well, that's good to know that there's a lot of resources out there to help educators and parents stay up to date on cutting edge research relevant to dyslexia. And you mentioned that the Hawaii Dyslexia Association has a website. And what is the URL?
It's hi.dyslexiaida.org.
So yes. That's good to know. Appreciate you sharing all that great information. Margaret, is there anything that you'd like to share with educational leaders, researchers, or policymakers as to how they can increase the awareness of dyslexia and help those with this disability?
Great question. So kind of going along with some of the things we've talked about before, you know, reading is fundamental. As I said, it affects us in so many aspects of our life, and it's not a special interest. I mean, this is something that affects all of us, whether we teach reading or not. We're going to have, patients in our office who maybe have difficulty reading instructions on the prescription bottle, or we're going to have, workers who confuse, time to report for a meeting or something. So it's really across the board. So I would say, a couple of things. In 2010, HIDA was part of a work group that the state legislature convened to look at teaching reading in Hawaii schools, because I'm sure, as you know, the reading scores were not very good. They were poor, so there's concern of, what can we do? So the comprehensive plan for teaching reading in Hawaii schools was presented to the state legislature in 2013. It's about 110 pages. And I would recommend that, educational leaders, policymakers, others take a look at that and see, a lot of the recommendations, some of the things we've talked about today are in that plan. Also look at the International Dyslexia Association Knowledge and Practice Standards for Teachers of Reading, which lays out, what the researchers, what IDA supports for teaching reading. And along with that, IDA has launched an initiative to accredit schools or colleges and other educator preparation programs. As we mentioned, I think early on in the conversation, if all kids would receive structured literacy instruction, if that was, just in the regular course of instruction, that would really help. So that is one thing that IDA has been working on. And there's, I think it's over 20 universities now that have received that accreditation. Unfortunately, none in Hawaii as of yet.
That's very good to know. And so glad that you're helping to drive that work? Because really, it's a multi-level approach, a multi- and a multi-prong approach.
Yes.
From the research level, the classroom level, school level,
right,
and just at the policy level as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'd like to shift gears a little bit. We're coming to the close of our show. So lastly, I'd like to ask people I'm privileged to meet either through this show or elsewhere, two questions. The first question, do you have a favorite book? And second, do you have a favorite quote?
You know, it's funny because when I was younger, I was a pretty avid reader. I'd go to the library and borrow 6-7 books. And, you know, a week later, I'm going back. And one of my favorite books at the time was The Little House on the Prairie series. And I think I was just fascinated by, you know, someone who or families just that, you know, they had to work and struggle for everything, and yet they were so happy. It was just simpler and, you know, just seeing how other people live. So that's kind of continued for me. Biographies, autobiographies. I can't really name one in particular. Actually, there is one that comes to mind. So I think it was in the 90s in Rwanda, they had what's kind of been called the Rwandan Holocaust, where, you know, it's fighting within the different, I don't know if they call them clans, but anyway, there was one woman, her name is Immaculée Ilibagiza, I think is how you pronounce it. And I actually had the chance to hear her speak about how she and several other women were hidden in a bathroom for months to really save them from being slaughtered. And so she's got to be in, I think, her 40s by now. But I read her book, and just amazing to come out with such a strong faith and such a strong, you know, forgiveness of those who were doing these horrible atrocities, people in her family died. So yeah, those kinds of, it just makes me really reflect and think how small I am in the larger scheme and how people with such incredible odds are able to do things. It just gives me a lot of hope and optimism just in my life and in general in the world.
That's terrific. Yeah, books truly open up a whole new world and possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
What about a favorite quote?
I don't know if it's really a quote, but maybe a saying. I'm always telling my kids, patience is a virtue. They're always like, yes, we know. But I said, no, it's true. I mean, you know, in personal life and work life, you know, sometimes just stepping back and allowing things to kind of mature and go about. And then the other one that actually I really like is, when life gives you lemons, make lemonades. And that, you know, and various versions of that. I'm definitely a glass half full person. And not to say that I don't get stressed, because I do, definitely. But just trying to look at, okay, how can we make a positive situation out of this? You know, how can we turn it around? And so that really speaks to me.
That's great. I love the books that you shared and the quote. You're definitely a very patient person, also persistent, and we appreciate all that you do. Well, Margaret, thank you so much for being a guest on the Pacific Education Pulse podcast. Our listeners and I appreciate you sharing your time and your personal experiences, as well as your expertise toward improving teaching and learning. And to our listeners out there, thank you for listening in. Remember to keep your finger on the pulse of education. Join us for another episode of the Pacific Education Pulse podcast. Mahalo.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. To learn more, hear other episodes, or subscribe to the Pacific Education Pulse podcast series, visit pacificeducationpulse.com. Until next time, aloha.